reader. I'm Cindy Burnett. Welcome to my award-winning podcast, Thoughts from a Page, which is a member of the Evergreen Podcasts Network. On the show, I chat with authors whose books I have enjoyed about their new releases, and I give you a peek behind the curtain of the publishing industry with my Behind the Scenes series. With so many books coming out weekly, it can be hard to decide what to read, so I find the best ones and share them with you. If you're looking for a community of readers, bonus content, and a chance to read books before they hit the shelves, I hope you'll consider joining my Patreon group, which is filled with a wonderful bunch of book lovers. The link to join is in the show notes. Do you love to be in the know about upcoming books? Kelly Hooker of At Kelly Hook Reads Books and I do too. We couldn't find a comprehensive list of titles all in one place, so we made one ourselves, and now we're sharing it with you. Our literary lookbook is a list of 182 books releasing from January to May 2024, curated for our communities. The link to buy it is in my show notes. Today I am chatting with John Clinch about The General and Julia. This is one of those books that sounded intriguing to me when I picked it up, but I had no idea how much I would love it. John brings Ulysses S. Grant to life as well as his wife Julia, and it's one of those books that will stay with me for a very long time. John is the author of the acclaimed novels Finn, Kings of the Earth, The Thief of Auschwitz, Belzoni, Dreams of Egypt, and Marley. A native of upstate New York, he lives with his wife in the Green Mountains of Vermont. I hope you enjoy our conversation.
History is complicated. The story of human progress is long, messy, and riddled with controversies big and small. On Conflicted, we dive headfirst into history's most infamous events and contentious figures. We try and untangle the good from the bad, the fact from the fiction, and the monsters from the misunderstood. Was Genghis Khan a murderous butcher or a civic pioneer? Did the Allied powers go too far in firebombing the German city of Dresden at the twilight of World War II? And how did the Marquis de Sade acquire such a sinister reputation? And was any of it true? These are just a few of the tough questions we wrestle with and investigate on Conflicted. So if you love history or just enjoy a good story, please join me, your host, Zach Cornwell, for a fascinating new topic each and every month. Conflicted, a history podcast, is available on Spotify, Apple, or wherever else you get your podcasts. I hope to see you soon.
Welcome, John. How are you today?
Very well, thank you. I've been nursing a cold, so if I cough at some point, I heard a woman coughing on NPR this morning. I guess it's the thing to do now. We'll see what happens.
That's too funny. I think there's so much junk going around, it's impossible not to cough these days.
There is. It was not to mess up here, but it was a book discussion, and this poor woman was, you know, sort of hacking away as I have been. There you go. Enough about that.
Well, first, I want to tell you congratulations because you had both a starred Kirkus and a starred book list review. And then Mary Calvey picked your book as one of her book club potentials. That's so exciting.
Yes, ma'am. That was unexpected. Well, actually, the two stars were not unexpected. I've always been treated very kindly by the critics and very, very kindly by critics at big newspapers back when my first novel was Finn in 2007, and that was in the days before a lot of decay had happened in the book reviewing, the book coverage business. But so that's always been nice for me. The CBS New York thing was a really interesting one for me and continues to be because completely out of the blue. I mean, I'm up against Jeffrey Deaver, a thriller writer, and Mitch Albom, I'm telling people that I am in some way the, it's not David and Goliath, it's more like Pee-wee Herman and Iron Man. It's a pleasure to be in the bout anyway.
Well, I voted for you. And I think she does a good job of picking a wide range of books. And usually there's at least one or two that I love that are on her list. So I feel like she and I are pretty well aligned.
Well, that's a good thing. That's a good thing. Yeah.
Fingers crossed. So before we dive into my questions, will you give me a quick synopsis of The General and Julia for those that haven't read it yet?
The General and Julia is a novel about, it was inspired by the last days of Ulysses S. Grant. And it's an historical novel that really begins early in his life and the life of his wife, Julia, when they're just courting and travels through in little slices. And it's not a full biography by any means, and it couldn't be because it's fictional anyhow, but it runs in slices all the way through until his death in 1885. It's a story of a person who, at the end, has lost almost everything. He was a great hero to the American people. He was a great hero and celebrity all around the world. He ultimately lost all of his money in a Ponzi scheme and was left with a cancer-ravaged body trying to write his memoirs so that he could leave something behind for his family, for his wife and children after he died. To me, that it's a story of love and heroism.
After I read this book, I realized I knew very little about him. And it's such a fascinating story. He had a long storied life, even though it was cut short with the cancer. He really did live a very busy life.
Yes, he did. Yes, he did. He did a lot of things. I mean, he started out as the son of a tanner. This stuff isn't really in the book, but he started out the son of a tanner in Ohio. Didn't much like working in the smelly tannery. Served time as a farmer and made some money for a while by selling firewood on the streets of St. Louis. This was not the highbrow life that people who we think about as getting into the presidency these days might have lived. So he did a lot. He did an awful lot. And it was fun to be able to go through his life and pick out those signal events from the life that he led.
Well, and I want to hear more about how you decided what to include. But before we talk about that, tell me how you even decided to write about him. Like, where did you become interested enough in him to decide, okay, this is my next topic for a book?
I've had a history of writing historical fiction. And actually, it's been historical fiction of a particular kind. It's been studies of fictional characters that we didn't know anything about or didn't know much about. So my first novel, as I said, was Finn, Huckleberry Finn's father. It was set in around 1840. And it just kind of came together with me as that's a time that I'm suited for some reason to writing about. I'm comfortable writing about that period. I've long been interested in Mark Twain as a reader, as a child, and then as a grown-up. Writing about some of his characters. I've got a big relationship with the Mark Twain house in Connecticut. And Mark Twain, I knew, would be a character in this book if I decided to write about General Grant because they were friends. So that kind of set the stage for me. When I read a full biography, Chernow's biography, probably 6 or 7 years ago of Grant, what really impressed me, what I really took away was that period at the end of his life when he was struggling against every kind of collapse and managed to pull it out of the fire at the very end, writing, in fact, the last words of his memoir 3 days before he died. So that was a real act of strength and decency and heroism of a sort that we don't usually associate with him. And that set my imagination going.
And Mark Twain helped with all of that, correct?
Yeah, Twain was a friend. Twain was substantially younger, but they had known each other for a long time. Something that people don't think about much is that when Grant was getting started waging the Civil War, Twain, whom he did not know, was deserting from the Confederate Army, which kind of strikes me as an interesting point of convergence and divergence. There, I don't know that. That the two ever might have discussed that would have made for an interesting thing. But they were good friends. Twain was, of course, a big success by that time. And Grant, who had an unfortunate habit, I think, not a bad habit, one that didn't serve him well, of expecting the best out of people. He was fooled a number of times in that way through his life, had expected the best out of a magazine editor who offered to publish his memoirs. And he learned just before signing the contract that the plan that he'd been offered was not nearly a fraction of what he should have been getting. And Mark Twain managed to offer him a package that not only got the book out there in good order, but got it read by hundreds of thousands of people, and in fact, made it the best-selling book of all time at that moment. Twain had just published Huckleberry Finn, and what do you know? Ulysses Grant outsold Huck even then.
I loved that connection.
Me too. It was fun to write Mark Twain, or Sam Clemens. I mean, he's really Sam Clemens in this book.
Right.
But it was fun to write for him after having read him for an awful lot of years now.
I bet. Well, that actually leads me right into my next question, what it was like writing both him and writing Grant. I mean, these larger than life figures, and you're putting words in their mouths and you're speaking for them and telling their story. What was that like?
Well, it kind of goes back to something that a great historical novelist, E.L. Doctorow, I remember, said or wrote something along this line in pointing out the difference between history and fiction. He said something like the historian tells you what happened and the novelist tells you how it felt. And the only way that you can get to what it felt like in the case of these two particular men and the other characters in the book who are known individuals is to reflect in a very sympathetic way, kind of a sympathetically imaginative way, on the things that we know happened to them. And look at those things in this particular case as a continuum, an accumulation of points of view and events and shifts in attitude that went in Grant's particular case from childhood in Ohio to death on a mountaintop in New York, with a huge number of adventures in between. And when you think hard enough about him and about his wife and about Mark Twain, you begin to want to get inside their heads. We know in some ways how Twain spoke. I mean, we know how he wrote, at any rate, as Mark Twain. So that voice was fairly, was kind of a fun challenge to take on. And we know what he was about relative to his friend Ulysses Grant. We know that he was not very fond of publishers. And we know that he was fond of Grant and was in a big hurry to rescue him from what he saw as not a dishonest publisher, but a publisher who wouldn't be doing the best by him. As for Grant, to me, he spoke to me in his physical nature, which kind of informs his language and his conversation. He was not a showy person. There's a scene in the novel where he's traveling by train and he's wearing old blue pants and a striped gray shirt without a collar. And he has his a white wool cap that his daughter had knitted him for Christmas pulled down to his eyebrows. And he is General Ulysses Grant at this point. But he is traveling as he always traveled, which is pretty much incognito. He was smaller than his reputation. He was plainer than his reputation. And that aspect of him stuck with me and made me want to look at him not as some lofty individual, but as a person among other people.
That's so interesting that you point that out, because I also thought it was such a contrast to the way you portrayed Lee and the way other people portray Lee as well, that he was showier and concerned about his appearance.
Yes.
And so the way the two interacted with each other and the gearing up for their meeting, all of that was so well done. It's one of my favorite parts of the book.
Hey, thanks for that. I really, that section, which I think covers two or three chapters, is a pretty substantial chunk of the early part of the book, I think. I didn't want to tell their story straight ahead. And I didn't want to have a narrative of the days leading up to Appomattox. I mean, anyone can do that. And everyone has done that.
That's what I was just going to say. And plenty of people have.
Yeah. So I had this idea that I could tell the story via Lee's brand new uniform. Because one thing we know is that he had a new uniform made for what would ultimately be his final meeting with Grant, however it turned out. And so the tailor becomes a character. And the tailor who manufactures this suit, this uniform, this elegant uniform, sends it off. We see him again only later. And the nature of the uniform remains secret from Lee right up until the day of the surrender. And it serves as kind of a totem throughout that section of the book, signifying that, you know what? It's sort of like Schrödinger's cat. there's this uniform in this package, and it could go either way. It could be a uniform that he wears at surrender, or it could be a uniform that he wears at triumph. And he doesn't know. He keeps it a secret from himself. And that was to me a good way to tell the story in a way that it hadn't been told before.
That was so well done. And it really speaks to what you were talking about before, making the reader feel versus informing them.
Yeah, I wanted to get inside Lee's head there. I mean, because he must have seen what was coming. You know, the South was rapidly failing. But I wanted him to have that bit of hope left inside that sailcloth wrapped package that has the uniform in it, and that there's, you know, I might unwrap this and triumph. Yeah, to me, that was kind of important.
I loved it. Well, how did you decide which aspects of Grant's life you were going to relay in the book?
The idea was always that it would be sort of a, well, I think there are 20-some chapters. My mother-in-law used to make a thing called a seven-layer cake that had a layer of pound cake followed by icing, followed by pound cake, followed by icing. And this is kind of a 20-layer cake in that the cake itself, the sponge, as they call it on the British baking show, is a long narrative, not long, but an extensive narrative of his life. And interrupting it are layers of the present day of the book, which is his last 40 days on Mount McGregor in the Adirondacks in New York. So it goes back and forth in time from a moving sequence to a more or less fixed sequence that gets interlaid between them. So I wanted to choose things for that cake that would represent and let me see him and let me show him and let me get inside his brain if I could in personal ways. There was no question that, and I forget where I found this bit of information, but when I learned about their courtship, Ulysses and Julia, I learned the story that she had had a parakeet. She was quite young. He was young as well. She had a parakeet who died. And I say who, I guess it should have been which, that. But she had a parakeet. The parakeet died. And her would-be suitor, Ulysses Grant, discovered it. And in the novel, he takes it upon himself to comfort her by building a little yellow coffin and burying it with all proper honors and reading from the Bible. And to me, that was just a moment because it actually happened, a moment that said, how could this young woman not fall in love with Ulysses Grant? And she did. I mean, obviously, from the very beginning, he was a tender-hearted individual. And it's a way to open a book about a person that people think of as a silhouette on a Civil War battlefield or the grumpy face on a $50 bill, and a way to open that story with a real personal connection. And similar stories like that, where people felt a real connection to him and where he had real personal interactions with the world, are what I wanted to use to make up the rest of that cake as it worked its way to the end.
The other thing that struck me was how beloved he was. You have one scene where he's on a train, and I'm trying to remember if it's right after the war or on his way to Washington, and all of these soldiers line up to greet him and are yelling, and then all of the people that showed up for his procession when he died and for his funeral and to view the body. I mean, he was really a hero.
Yes, he was. And those two scenes really reflect the reality on a big scale of his relationship to the public. I'm taken to saying that after his presidency, Ulysses Grant couldn't travel anywhere in the world without a parade breaking out. I mean, he was just that beloved, not only in America, but all around the world. And to look at him in a closer and more personal way, there is a stretch about three chapters long in the book about a fellow named Sam Willett. Now, Sam Willett was a real person. He was a soldier in Grant's army. He did not know Grant personally, but he had served under him during the Civil War. And when Willett found out, he was a pretty old man indeed, just like Grant. He was about my age, probably, which is kind of scary. But when he found out that Grant was ill and that he was spending a little time recuperating, or at least trying to feel a little better on this mountaintop in New York State. He got a train ticket and he went and he camped out. He brought all his own gear and he camped out right outside the house and served as a sort of a bodyguard and a sentry for the next month, and served as a gatekeeper, kept people away, kept curiosity seekers away, made sure that important figures who cared about him, whom he knew, could get in and see him. And this was his volunteer job for, 35, 40 days. He steadfastly stood by him. And to me, that was the best way to tell the story of how much people love the guy.
I agree. That was truly amazing. Befriended his grandkids, kind of kept them occupied. I just loved all of that. I really did like the way you chose to tell those vignettes. Instead of just going straight on, you would pick something and then weave it all around that. In fact, that was another thing, the cigars, because obviously he dies in the end from cancer, from the cigars. And you just kind of keep weaving them in like a little bit of foreshadowing, like, oh, I know this isn't going a good place for him.
Well, there's cigars and cigars and cigars. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Mark Twain smokes half of them. One of my favorite moments is when Grant has had to leave his office, which had a big humidor in it. Twain wonders what's happened to the cigars because he's accustomed to stealing lots of them. Or at least helping himself. But yeah, it was important to me. One of the tricks that, I shouldn't say tricks, but one of the techniques that a guy like me uses to establish time and place is something like that cigar, something like the music that gets played by a fiddler in an encampment someplace. Those things that appear sort of in the background, but are constant enough so that they give a flavor to the book. His cigar habit started, and I won't go into it in much detail, but it started because he was seen in the newspapers smoking a cigar. And suddenly the American populace decided that they needed to send Ulysses Grant cigars, and they needed to send them to him in enormous numbers, such that he ended up smoking 25 cigars a day. On average.
I mean, can you imagine 25 a day? I mean, you just feel sick to your stomach independent of how bad it is for you. Just all of that stuff, ingesting it. Ugh.
You would think. and it started out as a moment of, as a kind of gratitude on his
right,
part.
Right.
You know, these people were kind to him and they loved him, and he couldn't not smoke a cigar that they sent to him. Of course, He distributed lots of them to his soldiers, of course, as well, because he had far too many to smoke himself, even at 25 a day.
Right. But it's unintended consequences. And I just kept thinking that as the cigars were being woven in. And I was like, oh.
This is a book full of unintended consequences.
It really is.
Science, science, science. Science, science. Hello, podcast fans. Want to get weird with us? Come check out the Mad Scientist Podcast. We are a weekly show that looks at the history, philosophy, and hard facts behind your biggest paranormal questions.
Did the government really pay for a psychic spy program?
Yes!
Is it true that surgery got its start in grave robbing?
Yes!
Can a roller coaster really kill you?
Legally, we can't say so for sure, but sometimes,
yes! Mm.
Join myself, Chris Cogswell, and my co-host, Marie Mayhew, as we examine the science, philosophy, and history behind the strange and unusual. All to discover what's possible and plausible versus what's, well, just made up. Check us out wherever you find your favorite podcasts. The Mad Scientist Podcast.
Another thing that fascinated me was that Grant and his family were provided for when he left the White House. All of these wealthy individuals granted them money that they could have lived on for the rest of their lives if something else had not happened in the story. And I was just amazed by that. I had no idea things like that would happen.
Yeah. What we need to remember is something that nobody knows, nobody really remembers, is that when Grant served as the president of the United States, he had to give up his commission in the Army.
That's right.
And when you give up your commission in the Army, you give up your retirement benefits. And there was no retirement package for the president of the United States. So when he left the presidency, he had no income. as terrible as that was, his father-in-law had predicted that and predicted doom and dire consequences, which actually is what panned out. But, you know, this was the Gilded Age, and people, you know, financiers whose names you would recognize, who admired him. And once again, they admired him. They loved him. They wanted to see him lifted up. He had never played unfairly with them. He had never given advantages to the wealthy. He had never been dishonest to the American people. He had never done favors. But there was this feeling that here was a man who needed to be supported decently, and people came together, wealthy people. And then when, of course, he lost everything, and including the big amount of money that these wealthy benefactors had given him, little people came out of the woodwork. There were collections all around the nation where a town somewhere in, you know, somewhere in New York State, for example, would decide they were going to raise money for Ulysses Grant. If every child gives a penny and every adult gives a dollar, we can help Ulysses Grant. So it was the wealthy and the not wealthy who, during his last years, really reached out to do what they could.
GoFundMe in the pre-internet age.
Yes, it was. Yes, it was.
I just thought, you know, you don't think about a president needing that. But you're right. He didn't have his pension, which also seems kind of crazy.
Yeah.
And I think that changed eventually, right?
It did. It did. Yeah, it was sort of not GoFundMe. It was GoFund Ulysses.
Exactly.
Ulysses.
Right. Well, you mentioned the Mark Twain House earlier, and I know you played a role in helping it avoid foreclosure. And you obviously were interested in the Grant Cottage and brought it to life vividly in the book. So tell me a little bit more about why you're focused on these homes and what you believe the importance of historic homes are.
I like that question a whole lot. Now, I had not even known that Grant Cottage existed until after I finished writing the book. I can't even recall. You know, I know how I found out about it. I have a very dear cousin who my wife and I get together with him and his wife every summer. They live in around Syracuse, New York. And we usually meet at some midpoint. And he had the idea that we should meet at Grant Cottage. And I he knew I'd been writing a book about the subject. And it was a surprise to me. It's on a mountaintop, a low mountaintop. It's not really very high in the Adirondacks. And it's a little bit tricky to get to. And it's not a huge attraction, but it should be because it's, to me, it's really holy ground. You know, it's the place where it's interesting. I have a T-shirt from Grant Cottage that says founded 1885. Now, the cottage stood long before 1885, but 1885 was the year that he died. So I think that's a nice touch on that memorial T-shirt. But at any rate, the Twain House, I've gone back to the Twain House ever since my daughter was little, a long time ago. We've been lovers of the Twain House. Now, there are several Twain memorial locations. There's the Boyhood Home out in Missouri, and there's a home in Redding, Connecticut. But for me, the real one is in Hartford, Connecticut, and it's where he spent the grandest years of his life. It's right next door to the house owned by Harriet Beecher Stowe.
Really?
And yeah.
Oh, how interesting.
Yeah. They were next door neighbors. And it was a beautiful little suburban area when they lived there. And Twain had an enormous house built. You have to remember that he was Bruce Springsteen at the time. You know, he was an enormous cultural influence. And right next door, the author of Uncle Tom's Cabin lived in a little cabin. So between the two of them, they made an interesting pair. But the Twain House had fallen on hard times a few years ago. They had built a big museum out behind the house, and they had had some trouble with some employees. And I got word. Now, I had been there, done readings and speeches a number of times, and I got word that they were on hard times. I'd read it in the New York Times or somewhere. And I phoned up the director, who now actually runs the National Civil War Museum in Gettysburg or in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. And we cooked up a plan to bring in a whole bunch of writers who are friends of mine and use them to publicize the peril that the Twain House was in. They were only a couple of weeks from having to cut off payroll. It was terrible. What a terrible thing. But we managed to give them the infusion they needed. They came back to life. The place is in great condition. They continue to open more and more rooms. And you can go all the way up to the top. And in the very peak of the house, the attic space, you can see the table where Clemens and his friends played pool.
Okay, now I have to visit. This sounds like a trip that I need to make.
Oh, you do. I recommend it to everybody. It's magnificent.
It sounds like it. I always feel like that you learn so much when you visit those places. Like I've been to Faulkner's home in Oxford and Jane Austen's, you know, in different places like that. And it's just such a wonderful glimpse into their lives and what they were doing when they were writing.
You know, only a couple of, while you're traveling to Connecticut, only a little bit north of there in around North Adams, Pennsylvania, or North Adams, Massachusetts, is the house where Melville lived when he wrote Moby Dick.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, then, yes, I'm going to have to do a little author tour.
Yeah, good idea. And then you go a little bit to the east and you're at Edith Wharton's house. They were all up there.
Yes, there were a bunch in Massachusetts. I agree. So, yes, I'll have to make it a long trip and then get all the way up to Grant's cottage somehow.
There you go.
Well, and I was going to mention with respect to Grant, my daughter goes to Barnard. And so I was up there this fall and we were going on a walk in Riverside Park and we're walking along and I'm like, what is this beautiful building? And we walk over there and it's his mausoleum and it was closed at the time, unfortunately. But now after I've read your book, it is on my list. The next time I visit her, we're figuring out their hours and getting over there. And there's that huge housing complex, a government housing project that's named after him as well there, which I always was like, why is this named after him? This is so random, but it's not at all.
Yeah, you don't think of, I never did, think of him as a denizen of New York City.
I agree.
No, but he lived there for probably the last 20 years or so of his life. He was a New Yorker.
I thought that was so interesting. And now I'm dying to go in the mausoleum and it's so pretty and the line of trees coming out of the front of it. I mean, it's a beautiful structure.
Oh, it's the American Taj Mahal.
Mm-hmm. I love that you called it that.
Yeah, I mean, you can feel the reverence that people had for him there.
Definitely. Well, let's quickly talk about your stunning cover. Do you love it?
Oh, good Lord, I love that cover.
I mean, really.
Have you seen or do you have the final printed version?
No, but I clearly need to get it. I have the galley.
You need to get it because we can talk about what it looks like, although I'm sure you'll have a picture on your podcast. But it's the background is handwritten letter, like as if it were a letter from Grant to Julia. Overlaid on that are, actually what it is, it's leaves and flowers, but it's actually taken from a photograph of old Victorian wallpaper. Gee, I have to give so much credit to the cover designer because he brought together the idea of letters home from somewhere, and he brought alongside that the idea of home between the wallpaper and the handwritten letters. And in the hardcover, the leaves that you see are all embossed, and it's just it's a gorgeous piece of work. When they showed that book to me, when you've written a book, and as long as you have a good relationship with people, you get to comment on how the cover's coming along and so forth. And this one just knocked me out.
That's exactly what I thought when I first got an email about it and saw the cover. I was like, I don't even care what this book's about. I need to read it. It's so pretty. But then obviously it was just as good inside as it is outside.
Oh, thanks. Wait, to me, it seems like a book that if you pick it up in a bookstore, you will not want to go home without it.
Absolutely. Well, I'm going to get a hold of a physical final copy. Before we wrap up, John, what have you read recently that you really liked?
Ah, let me see. The one book that I always recommend is by Charles Frazier. You know Charles Frazier as the author of Cold Mountain and other books. A book that is his smallest book. It's called Nightwoods, and it's really a literary thriller. And it's very much different in weight and impact and so forth from his other novels. But by God, it's a work of enormous beauty. And I recommend Nightwoods everywhere I go. The other book that I would recommend is, one of the few novels certainly the only one I can think of in the last few years that I read right through and then turned back to page one and read it again is Nightmare Alley. I don't know if you saw the Guillermo del Toro movie based on Nightmare Alley. The author is William Lindsay Gresham, and it was it's a dark noir kind of a thriller, and it's set in the world of carnivals, and it's about a young man who decides that he can learn to be a mind reading artist and gets in loads of trouble. It's a beautifully written book. It's dark and dangerous, and I recommend Nightmare Alley with all enthusiasm.
I'm not familiar with either one of those, but I'm going to add them to my list, particularly the Charles Frazier one. That sounds really good.
Oh, it's great. It's great.
Good.
And they both start with the word night. Isn't that weird?
That is weird.
Yeah. Night Woods, Nightmare Alley. There you go.
You can set a trend.
Working on those night moves. I also recommend Bob Seger. So there you go.
There you go. Well, John, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with me. And I cannot wait for everyone to listen to our interview and then also to go out and read The General and Julia.
Well, thank you so much. Thanks for helping get the word out. I dearly love this book, and it's been fun to talk with you about it.
I thought it was very fun as well.
Great. Thank you.
I'm Ken Harbaugh, host of Burn the Boats from Evergreen Podcasts. I interview political leaders and influencers, folks like award-winning journalist Soledad O'Brien and conservative columnist Bill Kristol, about the choices they confront when failure is not an option. I won't agree with everyone I talk to, but I respect anyone who believes in something enough to risk everything for it. Because history belongs to those willing to burn the boats. Episodes are out every other week wherever you get your podcasts.
Are you tired of seeing your teen or young adult struggle on a path that clearly isn't the right fit? Is your teenager confused about which direction to take after high school? The future of work is changing rapidly, and our kids need to know all of the options available after high school so they're empowered to make the choice that is best for them. In each episode, we explore the latest trends that are shaping the opportunities of today and tomorrow. I'm your host, Betsy Jewell, and this is the High School Hamster Wheel Podcast.
Thank you so much for listening to my podcast. I would love to connect with you on Instagram or Facebook, where you can find me at Thoughts From A Page. If you enjoy the show, please consider joining my Patreon group to access bonus content and support the podcast. If you have a moment to rate the show or subscribe to it wherever you listen to your podcasts, I would really appreciate it. It makes a big difference. And please tell all of your friends about Thoughts From A Page. Word of mouth does wonders to help the show grow. The book discussed in this episode can be purchased at my bookshop storefront, and the link is in the show notes. I hope you'll tune in next time.
Hello, and welcome to Novel Conversations, a podcast about the world's greatest stories. I'm your host, Frank Lavallo, and for each episode of Novel Conversations, I talk to two readers about one book, and together, we summarize the story for you. We introduce you to the characters, we tell you what happens to them, and we read from the book along the way. So if you love hearing a good story, you're in the right place. Our ninth season is coming this fall. Tune in to hear from some of the all-time great authors, Charles Dickens, Jules Verne, F. Scott Fitzgerald, and more. Subscribe to Novel Conversations wherever you listen to podcasts.